I'm going to tell you about microscopic description of black rings. But before that, I'd like to thank Amanda. Sorry, that should be Don. Don and Per, not only for organizing a very fruitful workshop and for the opportunity to speak, but also for providing my collaborators and me with the cheesiest possible title for this morning session. And I thought I would confront you with this fact that would clarify once and for all something that people have been asking me since Monday, which is, who is who in this story? And I didn't expect it, but actually this gives me the opportunity to do the thing that I have enjoyed the most in this collaboration, which is to contradict Harvey. Because at least Henrietta and Roberto agree with me that I am Frodo. And unfortunately, I used to think it's because they believe I am the driving force in this collaboration, but apparently it's because I'm short and hairy. And okay, so enough for the jokes. Before you ask me, there is one thing, so please interrupt me anytime and I will try to answer the question, but there is one thing that I will only discuss in private, which is who's Gollum. Okay, so even though Harvey motivated very well why supersymmetric black rings are interesting, I thought I would just mention a couple of things. So they established non-uniqueness in the supersymmetric sector, they established stability of black rings, but my main interest was the implications that they have for the microscopic counting of entropy of black holes in string theory. The reason is that because they violate uniqueness, it's clearly not enough now to count BPS states in some dual CFT to reproduce the entropy, because those quantum numbers, by looking at the quantum numbers, because those are not enough to characterize the black ring. So you need more parameters. But the key point is that, and the focus of this talk, is that not only this is not enough, but it's actually not right. So as we'll see, the BPS states you have to count carry different quantum numbers as the black ring. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that this happens. So I think it's interesting. And not only black rings, supersymmetric black rings raise this puzzle, but also they provide the ideal arena to address it, because they are supersymmetric, so we have good control. We know the microscopic constituents, and that's going to be the first part of my talk. And we understand the stability mechanism. And by the way, this stability mechanism is a little bit different from just balancing gravitational attraction against centrifugal force for the supersymmetric ones. Okay, so the microscopic constituents are supertubes. What's a supertube? You can think of it as the simplest example of brain expansion in flat space. It's the simplest one because it takes place in flat space. You don't need any background fields to induce it. It's just induced by angular momentum. So the way it goes is, suppose you start in type 2A string theory with a bunch of fundamental strings and D0 brains in flat space. That's a one-quarter supersymmetric system. And now you add angular momentum. Then the statement is that this system will blow up into a tubular bound state into which a D2 brain is created in the expansion, and the original charges are bound to the D2 brain. And the key point is that this expansion preserves the same supersymmetries you started with. So the way these original charges, which are of course conserved in the expansion, appear in the new system is as dissolved fluxes. So I remind you that an electric flux on a D2 brain corresponds to a string charge, and a magnetic flux that you can think of as threading the surface is the D0 brain charge. And this is also the way the angular momentum is carried by this system, because once you have electric and magnetic fluxes, you take the cross product, and that gives you a pointing vector. So that's a linear momentum density, which when you integrate around the cross section, gives you a net angular momentum. Of course, because this is supersymmetric, the energy is just given by the sum of the charges. And one thing that came as a slight surprise to us is that actually the cross section, you might have thought because of stabilization by angular momentum, and in particular because of supersymmetry, has to be a perfect circle. But that's not the case. You can choose an arbitrary curve in the transverse directions to the axis, and that will preserve the same supersymmetries. In fact, a posteriori, perhaps this shouldn't have been surprising, because if you TS dualize this system along the axis, you get a string, a fundamental string, with a wave on it. And you know that if, as long as the wave is moving at the speed of light in only one direction, left or right moving, this system, for any profile, for the wave, preserves the same supersymmetries. And that arbitrariness in the profile of the wave, by duality, translates into the arbitrariness of the cross-section. And finally, one thing that's very important is that these V2 brains here, the number of V2 brains, is a parameter you have to specify in order to have to determine the system. However, they don't carry, as Harvey explained, they don't carry a conserved charge. From this point of view, the reason for that is very simple. It's because they wrap a contractible cycle. The cross-section is contractible. And physically, another way of saying that is that if you look at a little bit of strip of the V2 brain on this side and on the opposite side, they look locally like a pair of brain antibrains. So they carry a net V2 brain charge density, but the integrated total charge is zero. But of course, you still have to specify the number of V2 brains, and that's these little cues here that Harvey told you how to compute in supergravity. So that's the origin of non-uniqueness. Now, what I just described to you are supertubes with two charges, which were discovered a few years ago. Now, the point is that if you want to use them to construct a black object in five dimensions, then you know from your experience with black holes that you need at least three charges to have a finite area horizon. So the idea is to construct three-charge supertubes. And the best microscopic description is provided by the in-theory lift. You'll see why later. So the system I just told you about with fundamental strings and D0 brains and D2 brains can be dualized and lifted to two membranes, which intersect along a point, which are blown up into a five brain that shares those original directions together with the cross-section direction psi. So that's a two-charge system and one dipole system. The idea is to add a third membrane, as Harvey described, and then each pair, when you add angular momentum, each pair of membranes will expand into a different five brain. So you see you have three different pairs here, first and second, first and third, second and third, and each of them gives you the corresponding five brain. So this system now will have three charges and three dipoles. And when you compactify on a six torus, these common directions here, you're left with four plus time five transverse directions. So you suppress all of them except for the cross-section, and that's what gives you the five-dimensional black ring, as Harvey explained. So I'm going to use psi as the polar angle in the plane of the ring, and phi as the angle in the orthogonal two-plane. And the feature I want to concentrate on is that I should have emphasized, for the two-charge case, if you take the cross-section to lie in a given two-plane, you don't have to do that. You can take it to wander off in space. But if you take it to lie to be contained in a two-plane, then the system only carries angular momentum in that two-plane, as you would expect. For the black ring, that's not the case. With three charges, it turns out, and sufficient number of dipoles, in particular with three dipoles, it turns out that there's also an angular momentum in the orthogonal two-plane. Okay? And the part of the purpose of this talk is to discuss where the second angular momentum is coming from, microscopically. Okay, so, and we know we need seven parameters to specify the solution, so as Harvey explained, that means we only have five conserved charges, so that leads to this infinite violation of uniqueness at the classical level by two continuous parameters. So you have to choose what parameters you want to treat as independent. In particular, it's convenient to choose the membrane charges, the five ring dipoles, and J psi being the angular momentum in the plane of the ring. Okay? That's a choice you can make. If you do that, then the entropy, namely the area divided by 4 times Newton's constant, takes this form here. So it's a function of the charges, the dipoles, and the angular momentum. And this is the formula that I want to reproduce with a microscopic calculation. Okay? This is the classical entropy, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Now, in order to address that, let me first discuss what Harvey briefly mentioned, which is the black string limit. That consists of taking the radius of the ring to infinity, keeping the membrane charge density per unit length along the ring constant. In that limit, the ring becomes an infinite string. And it turns out, this was discussed by Josef Benner, it turns out in that limit, of course, the angular momentum in the plane of the ring, around the ring, becomes just linear momentum along the string, but the second angular momentum in the orthogonal plane disappears. So this suggests, and this is what I'm going to try to advocate, that this second angular momentum is not carried by the microscopic excitations on the ring, because if it were, there is no reason why it should disappear just because I take the string And rather than tying up in a loop in space, I just extend it and periodically identify it. That's the first indication. So my proposal is that this J-phi is actually entirely generated by crossed electric and magnetic supergravity gauge fields. So symbolically, it will take some form, as I've written here, an integral of some space-like hypersurface of the cross product between the electric and magnetic components of the supergravity 4 form in 11 dimensions. And I'm going to be much more precise about this formula a bit later. But for now, let me give you the first consistency check. So if you look at the case in which the cross-section of the five brains, this ring, is actually a straight line, it turns out that the electric and magnetic fields sourced by the membranes and the five brains are aligned. You can show that based on a symmetry argument. You don't need to know the solution for that. And therefore, you can prove that their cross product is zero. So there is no J-phi generated in this case. However, as soon as you bend the cross section to close it into a loop, you have to apply a torque. And then these two fields become misaligned, and they generate a non-zero cross product, which integrates. In fact, the overall scale is given by this quantity, which is precisely what sets the scale of J-phi in the supergravity solution. So that's the proposal. Now, let me give you more evidence that the second angular momentum, this quantum number, is not carried by the microscopic Wahr volume theory. And for that, I need to construct our Wahr volume description of this three-charge, three-dipole object. It turns out the first step, a very important step, was given by Josef Venn and Per Krauss. They constructed, in type 2A string theory, a system that carries these three net charges and two dipoles, the D2 brain dipole and D6 brain dipole. But it turns out that in string theory, no matter what uduality frame you go to, there is always one of the dipoles is always either an NS5 brain or a Kaluza-Klein monopole. Namely, it's an object for which we don't have a good open string description. So that's problematic if you want to write down a microscopic Wahr volume description. This problem can be circumvented by going to M theory, because in this case, you can go to a frame in which the three charges are membranes, as I said, and the three dipoles are five brains. And we do know how to write down an effective action, low-energy effective action, for an abelian M5 brain. And this is what I'm going to use. And as we will see, this is enough to count the entropy. Okay, so to explain that, let's forget about the membranes for a second. Let's just look at three five brains intersecting over a line, not over an arbitrary cross-section, but for the moment over a straight line. In this case, it is very well known that you can, these three five brains intersect, give rise to a singular intersection, because they are hyperplanes intersecting over a smaller, lower dimensional space. But you can resolve that intersection by replacing, while preserving the same supersymmetries, by replacing this fourth surface inside this sixth space by any holomorphic two surface. This preserves the same supersymmetries, and this is well known. The key point is that, and this system will only carry five brain charges. The key point is that for any choice of holomorphic two surface, so this is a surface of real dimension four, you can turn on appropriate fluxes on the five brain. Remember, there's a self-dual two-form potential living on the five brain, in such a way that that induces membrane charge, and at the same time generates a linear momentum density along the cross section that allows you to replace the straight line over which they intersected by any cross-section, an arbitrary curve in space-time. So it's literally the same supertube mechanism I told you about in the beginning, but generalized to three charges. And of course, if you choose the cross-section to be a contractible loop, then the system will not carry anymore any five-brain charges, only dipoles, but it will now carry membrane charges. So the upshot is that this description captures the three dipoles explicitly and the three charges, but there is no trace in this description of J-phi. If you take the cross-section to lie in a given two-plane, the only quantum number that's carried is angular momentum in that two-plane. Okay? So let me tell you now how you use this description to count, to reproduce the formula I wrote down before for the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It turns out that we didn't have to do too much, because the calculation is literally uses a result that Maldacena, Stramitz, and Witten and Waffa derived already with a slight modification. So let me tell you what they did, and then I'll tell you how you modify it. What they did, they were interested in black holes in four dimensions. So they considered M-theory compactified on T6, or more generally a Calabi-Yau free space, cross S1. And they took a five brain with arbitrary warp-volume fluxes, namely membrane charges, wrapped on a divisor in the Calabi-Yau, on a surface of dimension of real dimension 4, holomorphic surface in T6, and the extra dimension of the five brain was wrapped on the space-time S1, and of course that gives you a point-like object in four dimensions, so you get a BPS black hole. And the way they reproduced the entropy of this black hole was the following. You consider the low energy effective action of the five brain, which you're allowed to do because you're generically in the moduli space of holomorphic two surfaces in the Calabi-Yau. These are smooth and don't self-intersect. So you don't need to understand the non-abelian five brain action. Everywhere locally there's a smooth single five brain. Because it wraps a compact surface, you can Kaluza-Klein reduce that action down to a 1+1 CFT. And that CFT has some central charge that you can compute in terms of the five-brain charges, which is given by this expression. And then there's also momentum going around the S1 that appears as a charge in the 4D black hole. And then you apply Cardy's formula, and you get that the entropy is given by this expression, where this P prime is not directly the momentum around the S1, but it differs by a shift that's induced by the presence of membrane charge. This is the MSW effect that was discussed by Bernard yesterday. And there is also a zero-point shift in the momentum. Yes?
I'm sorry, could you say again, if these Qs are not 1, so they can be large, presumably, the dipole charges.
Yes.
Why are we justified in considering this a single and five-brain?
Because this is a five-brain that wraps some complicated divisor in your Calabi-Yau 3 space. But what Maldacena, Strominger, and Witten show is that under a certain assumption that has to do with being justified in using looking at black holes in four dimensions, that surface is in the moduli space. There are points at which this surface intersects, but those are basically, roughly speaking, have measure zero in the moduli space. So the entropy comes from a large, so the leading contribution to the entropy comes from smooth complex two surfaces in the Calabi-Yau. That's the key point, yeah. And that's one point that they emphasize, which I think is very, yeah. Yes, yeah, so these three authors considered specifically a Calabi-Yau with proper SU3 holonomy. Baffa actually considered the general case, in which you also allow for K3 cross T2 or T6. Of course, his paper is a bit more obscure. So, but actually, these people here also mention the modifications you would have to do to consider the other two cases. And it turns out that for the leading contribution to the entropy, there is no difference. There are subtleties when you go to the first correction, but not to the leading result. Generically, they will not coincide. That's a key point. Yeah. That's what gives the main contribution to the entropy. That's the point. I'm only interested. Okay. So the key point, the key difference between T6 and a Calabi-Yau with proper SU3 holonomy is that in the case of a Calabi-Yau, this theory here in the non-supersymmetric sector has only bosons. Okay? And those bosons don't carry, that was the point I was going to try to make in the following transparency. Okay, so let me not make it now. There are only bosons. The field content in the case in which you have K3 cross T2 or T6 includes also fermions and gauge fields. But those, the number of those is subleading in the large charge expansion. So, did I answer your question? Okay, maybe it's a slightly technical point, so perhaps I can, I'm happy to discuss it afterwards. Maybe I can continue. Yes.
I think that Gary's question, isn't it the case that whether or not it's the overlapping or not overlapping that causes it to dominate depends upon which charge is the largest? So, it's correct.
Okay, yes, yes. Okay, so, but the point I wanted to emphasize is that there is this shift to the momentum that enters, because this is really the energy or momentum that you really have to freely distribute amongst the oscillators. Okay, these are zero-point contributions or shifts that are constant. So, in our case, we are interested not in compactifying down to four dimensions, but down to five dimensions. So what we're going to do is to consider the same wrapped five brain with the same fluxes, with the difference that now this S1 doesn't need to be wrapped on a topologically non-trivial cycle. It's stabilized by the angular momentum going around the circle. But intrinsically speaking, from the point of view of the five brain, there is absolutely no difference intrinsically as far as the CFT living on the string is concerned. That's the key point. So you can mimic the same procedure, Kaluza Klein reduce, and obtain an effective CFT. And the point is that what they call the momentum going around the S1 becomes, of course, the angular momentum once you factorize Newton's constant, etc., so that you get two integers. That corresponds to the angular momentum in the plane of the ring. So with that identification, you write down Cardy's formula, and you plug in the expression for P prime, and then this expression reproduces exactly the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy that I wrote down for you before, a few transparencies ago. But the point that I would like to emphasize is that this counting here is counting BPS states in this CFT that carry zero J phi. So, J phi is the U1 symmetry in the plane orthogonal to the ring.
But in terms of the zero quark component, is it the charge under the
S2R symmetry? It's an R charge, yes. Okay, so we are counting states that carry different quantum numbers as the black ring. And the reason why that's one thing that had to happen, which is not the only one, but one thing that had to happen for this to be possible, is that the entropy depends on seven parameters, which you can choose to be such that they don't include J phi. Okay, so my proposal is that this J phi is generated by taking the infinite black string and bending it into a circle to close it over itself. In that process, you have to apply a torque, which is reproduced by the supergravity solution. In the sense that this J phi is then generated, is carried by the supergravity fields. But it's not associated to the source. However, I would like to emphasize that this counting is actually in the same spirit, it's not different in spirit, from the first counting done by Strominger and Baffa. Because what you're doing is, first of all, we are using the dipoles to characterize the CFT, even though they're not conserved charges. But nobody has ever proven, or it's not written anywhere, that the only thing you have to use to characterize your CFT are conserved charges. And this is an example of that. What you have to do is to understand your system and see how you determine the microscopic constituents of your system. And in this case, you have to determine the number of fibrains in the system, because that determines the central charge. And in this case, that's measured in the supergravity description by the flux integrals that Harvey wrote down for the dipoles. Okay, so let me now be more precise about what I mean by the angular momentum being carried by the supergravity fields. Yes?
So
it's a complicated expression that depends on the dipoles and the membrane charges. Yes. That's right. Okay. So in general relativity, if you don't have any symmetries, you can only define asymptotic quantities, namely mass, angular momentum, and charges. But if you have killing vectors in your solution, then you can define local quantities, local charge densities, or local densities for angular momentum in particular. So in our case, in the black ring, we have two U1 symmetries, the one in the plane of the ring and the one in the orthogonal one. So if you take K to be the killing vector associated to either of those symmetries, you can construct a one form by lowering its indices, take D of that and the dual, and integrate that over the boundary of some volume. And that's called the Cromer integral, and that measures for you the total amount of the associated charge contained in that volume. Okay? So for the ring, if you compute this quantity for either killing vector at infinity, for the S3 at infinity, what you're doing is measuring the total amount of angular momentum of the solution. And of course, you get the same result as the ADM type formula gives. So for the first one, you get J psi, and for the second one, you get J phi. You can also do this computation at the horizon. And what you get for on the S1 versus 2 horizon of the ring, what you get for the one associated to the angular momentum in the orthogonal plane is zero. What that means is that this second angular momentum is completely contained in the volume between infinity and the horizon. It's completely, entirely carried by the gauge fields outside the horizon. However, for the first one, you don't get zero at the horizon. You get exactly P prime being the shifted momentum or the level that you're really free to distribute amongst the oscillators. And we don't really understand why this is the case or why this should be the case, but it's quite remarkable that supergravity can measure for you with an integral at the horizon those shifts that come from quantum effects in the CFT. So if you now turn this into a conjecture, in fact we have verified that this is the case for all supersymmetric solutions, supersymmetric black holes that are known. So it seems to work in all supersymmetric cases. So if you make the conjecture that that's generally true, then this provides a new way of comparing the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy with the microscopic entropy. Because now, if you give me the supergravity solution, I can compare that with the microscopic description with no need of measuring the membrane charges. All I need to know is the central charge, which I read off from the near horizon geometry, from the radius of the ADS3 near horizon geometry, and this quantity that I compute by an integral at the horizon. Then I write down this expression, and that's the entropy, and I can go and compare with the microscopic prediction. So I don't need to know the membrane charges. They're of the P prime to J psi. Generically, they're of the same order. P prime. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you're asking. Yes, okay. Yeah, P prime is generically smaller than J psi. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time. 5 minutes, okay. Well, I'll give you 5 minutes to appreciate the last message. So in case that you take anything away from this talk, the only thing I want you to take away is that the microscopic constituents of supersymmetric black rings are supertubes. Thank you.
So in the spirit of your last comment about the distribution, if you did the same thing for the time-like scaling field and asked what's the mass of the ring, what do you get?
If I remember correctly, we get zero at the horizon. Is that correct? I agree. No, so, okay, so one possible way of reading that result is to say that the integral for the time-like killing vector at the horizon is actually measuring the amount of energy above extremality. which is zero for a supersymmetric solution. You don't get zero for a non-extremal solution. However, we haven't been, that's what we are looking at, and we haven't been able to understand the result in a non-extremal case entirely. Because if you notice, just a second, if you notice for the one associated to the momentum, what you get is really the momentum above the ground state. That is really free for you to distribute amongst the different oscillators. And that's why that's the one that enters the entropy formula, Cardy's formula. So, but I agree, I would like to understand these results better, yeah. Sorry, I think Amanda had a question first. My pleasure. Yeah, so I can't give you a concrete answer because that's the case we don't understand well enough yet. So no, that's work in progress. All I'm saying is that one possible way of reading the results for the supersymmetric case is that the entropy for the momentum really is measuring the excitation level above the ground state. So once you factor out all the shifts that come from zero point energies and so on. So if the same were to be true for the energy, then it's just a conjecture that it's measuring the energy above extremality. But we haven't been able to understand it completely in the non-extremal case. So I can't. Yeah, sure. Yes, that's what Harvey described. If you take the decoupling limit, you get still a complicated solution, which nevertheless near the boundary becomes ADS3 cross F3. Okay, so I wasn't planning to elaborate on this, but since you ask, let me try to answer that. So if you take that decoupling limit, as Harvey explained, you get a complicated geometry, which nevertheless simplifies in two regions. Near the boundary, you get ADS3 cross F3, and near the infrared, you get again ADS3 cross F3. And you can interpret it as an RG flow because the central charge is strictly decreasing. Now, the counting I did, this is my, the way I understand what's going on is, the counting I did corresponds to counting the entropy, or the BPS states, in the infrared CFT, in the fixed point in the infrared, which you can do. And that counting counts states with no J phi. What you're saying is, if I have asymptotically ADS3 cross S3, then everything should be contained in the holographic dual theory, in the UV. That's, in some sense, the most fundamental theory. And in this theory, if you count it here, you will have to count J-phi. And this is consistent because you can show that there is a non-zero J-phi density in the fields in between when you go from the infrared to the UV. I haven't thought carefully enough about that, but the words that I can put to it, without having carefully examined it, is that what is inducing this RG, there's something that's breaking the conformal invariance here and inducing the RG flow. And I suspect that's turning on some VEPs for some operators. And I think what's happening is that the states that contribute to the entropy here are the ones that remain massless as you run the RG flow. The other ones decouple in the RG flow, but they don't contribute to the entropy. So, but I can't be much more concrete about it because I haven't really... I think understanding this RG flow and understanding how this dual CFT encodes... Because I should say one nice feature about that is that this CFT, in fact, because it's in the UV, and it's the same one for both for the BMPV black hole and for the black ring, it actually encodes both of them. So you should be able to describe within the same CFT in different sectors both types of black holes. But I think understanding this in detail is an open question.
So these black rings will have some Gaussian orbit, which will preserve the entropy.
These
black rings will have a Gaussian orbit, which will preserve the entropy. And the story with these black holes was that there were some cubic invariants, the supergravity that appeared out of the square root. Do you happen to know what the perfect quartic or higher order invariants?
Well, no. Here it should be a cubic invariant because it should be an E6 invariant because these are five-dimensional solutions. And they're
used. You had four choices, so you have two prime multiplying two or two
under. Good. No, those are not. Okay. So in five dimensions, those are dipoles. The little cubes are the. Yes, but these solutions are five-dimensional solutions. So they are only obliged to be E6 invariant, not E7 invariant. In order to have an E7 invariance, you have to be able to reduce the solution to four dimensions. So, not, for example, when you reduce to four dimensions, J psi, the angular momentum, so in five dimensions, the angular momenta do not enter the u-duality transformations. But if you compactify the string and reduce, then it becomes linear momentum, and that enters the u-duality transformations. Okay, so there's a very non-trivial story when you reduce. All I'm saying is in five dimensions, strictly speaking, you're only allowed to require E6 invariants. And in fact, you can write down the entropy formula that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in terms of E6 invariants.
Okay, maybe we should take more questions in private. Yeah. And David, again.